From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
Jeffrey Robertson has a long resume. He's a lawyer, judge, academic, author, television host. As an expert in human rights law, he's led Amnesty International missions, worked for the European High Court and the United Nations, and founded his own firm handling international constitutional and media law. He's published 11 books, the latest concerning a 17th century event that set a precedent for the trials of modern dictators like Slobodan Milosevic and Saddam Hussein. It's called The Tyrannicide Brief, the story of the man who sent Charles I to the scaffold, and it's published by Pantheon Books. I'm very pleased it has brought Jeffrey Robertson to my show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
Can you start by setting the stage for us? What was going on in England during the reign of Charles I?
A lot of Proto-Americans were being persecuted and tortured. In the 1630s, John Winthrop, a lawyer from Essex, led 30,000 Puritans across the pond to New England.
To escape torture.
I mean, we're really relevant here, because what happened was that the preachers who were the Puritan leaders, they defied the bishops, they were dealt with by a kangaroo court that had been set up by Charles I called the Star Chamber. That was the king's private court, and they would torture. They would slit noses, they would cut off ears, and they would brand on the head, SL for seditious libeler, these Puritan preachers. And 30,000 Puritans crossed the sea, including the daughter of Edmund Reed, who married into the Winthrop family, and in the course of centuries that produced John Kerry and George W. Bush. An awful lot of Americans can
We could only wonder what would have happened if Charles I had been a different kind of a king.
But they came back, because there was this in the 1640s, the king, Charles I, believed that he ruled by divine right.
But I wonder, well, and so had his predecessors. Henry VIII broke with the Catholic Church.
Right.
And we're talking, for a while, the wars were between the Protestants and the Catholics. Now we're talking about Protestants and Protestants.
Yeah. Yeah, we're talking about the Puritans and the Presbyterians, who were the really dour Calvinists, and the rather upper church Anglicans like the king, who wanted to keep some of the vestiges of Catholicism, the stained glass windows, the graven images as the Puritans saw it. But it wasn't just about religion, because back in Charles's father, James I, who'd taken over in 1603 when Elizabeth died, he was the great apostle of absolutism. He believed, following Machiavelli, that kings had absolute
power. But he also gave us the King James Bible.
He did, but he had a stand-up row with his Chief Justice, Edward Coke, about whether the king could sack, hire, and fire judges who displeased him. Judges, he said, should never rule against me, because I'm the king and I appoint the judges. And Coke said, well, wait a minute, Your Majesty, the law is the golden meat one that protects you as well as us. And the king went to punch him on the nose, but missed, because Coke was groveling at his feet. But in time, Coke and other judges who ruled against the government, against the king, were sacked, because judges had no security of tenure. They existed at the king's pleasure. And the king abolished Parliament. Parliament got very uppity. In 1628, when Charles came to the throne, they reinvented Magna Carta as a declaration of right. And this was the first human rights law they tried to pass, and the king was so angry that he abolished Parliament for 12 years. And so it was only in 1640 when he was forced to call Parliament, because he couldn't wage war on Scotland without some money, that things really started to happen. And what we get as a in 1642, by 1642, when the king attacked Parliament and started the Civil War, was an amazing... We abolished torture, we abolished Star Chamber, and Parliament insisted that it should share sovereignty with the king. So our democracy, American as much as English, goes back to these Civil War years when Parliament established a proto-democracy, in effect, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, as long as you weren't Catholic, and freedom of the independence of the judges, and the end of torture. Torture in England. I mean, it went on, and the French tortured for centuries, but in England, and America for that matter, the last torture warrant was the Star Chamber warrant in 1641.
And we won't, we will wait and maybe never even address the issues today, because they are separate, but it is interesting that it was ended then, and only now are we discussing whether torture is acceptable again in our society. But here we have Charles I and Parliament raising arms against each other.
Yeah, they went to
war. And Parliament gets the upper hand and then goes further and decides to put the king on trial. Now, is Parliament dominated by Cromwell and his supporters,
the Roundheads? Not at first. There were characters like Pym and Hampden. There were these great men. A lot of Harvard graduates, in fact, the first graduating class of Harvard, came back and fought and became major generals under Cromwell. But the civil wars rage between 1642 to 1646, and more people die comparatively than died in the trenches in the First World War. 1 in 10 Englishmen was killed. It was an incredibly bloody for decades. All English cities were full of beggars with one arm or one leg as a result of this terrible war started by the king. But there was this irony that, as someone said to Cromwell, we beat the king 99 times, and he's still king, because he's there by divine right. He beats us once, and our heads are cut off. So the paradox, after 1646, the king was, as it were, in the power of Parliament, but he was still king. And he had hundreds of servants in his... He was under house arrest, or castle arrest, I guess you'd call it. But they couldn't... he was still the enemy commander, was their king, and he plotted a second civil war, which Cromwell and Fairfax had to put down in 1648, and not that he went on to plan a third civil war. So what to do with this man of blood, the soldiers who'd lost comrades and limbs as a result of this malevolent man who was determined to bring himself back to absolute power? He would not agree to share power in any way with Parliament. And that the only solution, as 1648 drew to a close, and there was the king's army in Ireland about to invade, he had a fleet in Holland, was to put this man of blood on trial.
Well, why that? Why not do what previous kings would have done and simply assassinate him?
Well, that must have been tempting, but you've got to remember these people, this extraordinary breed of men and women, were believers in the divine, in the Bible, in a particular sense. They believed, they were providentialists, they believed that everything that happened was a result of God's will, and they wanted to show God. They weren't going to stoop to crime. They hated crime. They wanted to succor the poor. They were good people who believed that everything they did should be done openly and in the sight of God. And that's why we get this extraordinary trial. I mean, all the other inconvenient monarchs, or Anne Boleyn and Mary, Queen of Scots, had been bumped off in private after a kangaroo court hearing in secret. But no, the Puritans were going to give him a fair trial in the largest room in the country, which was Westminster Hall.
My guest is Jeffrey Robertson, and his book, The Tyrannicide Brief, The Story of the Man Who Sent Charles I to the Scaffold, is published by Pantheon. So let's talk about that man, John Cook. Mm-hmm. And he plays a major role in the history of England, and yet I don't think anyone recognizes that name today.
You've got to remember that English tell their own story, and they've told their own history, and they hate the fact that for 11 years they were a republic, and they were a republic because the king was prosecuted and his head was cut off. And there's the famous story about the MP who went to the House of Commons library and said, "You have a book on the Republic," and was met by shocked silence until finally the librarian said, "Oh, sir, you mean the interregnum." Mm-hmm.
The English, but it's also been called the dictatorship, and I think reasonably, Cromwell did wind up becoming the dictator of England and doing some awful things.
Becoming a king in all but name, but for 4 years there was a genuine attempt to turn this into a republic. But in order to understand that, you've got to understand the thinking of John Cook and his friend Hugh Peters, who was the founder of Harvard College, and a lot of the Puritans who indeed came back to England to be part of this movement. It wasn't originally a Republican movement, but they got to that point as a result of, first of all, their belief in Magna Carta and the principle that no one should be above the law. Secondly, their belief in the Bible in the first book of Samuel, that kings were graven images displeasing to God. And thirdly, and this is the strand that Milton, the great poet and author of Paradise Lost, brought in, that they would be more free as individuals. They would be better human beings if they weren't shackled by allegiance to a king.
So what was the public response at the time? Was Cook considered a hero?
John Cook, let me just sketch a little, was an extraordinary figure. He was the son of a tenant farmer. He was the son of a sharecropper, a poor man. He was a plebeian. And he wasn't even supposed to have become a lawyer, because James had said that rather dangerous for the lower classes to learn the law, and had banned them from learning the law. You had to be the son of a gentleman. And it was a miracle that he even got into the bar, into Oxford. He was it was a Wadham College, the gift of for poor Puritans, that he got there. And he had become, I suppose, the most radical lawyer in Britain. He had acted for John Lilburn, the leveller, in the case that established the right to silence, the Miranda warning that has to be given now, and that was in 1946. And he had written the first code of ethics for barristers. He had attacked his colleagues for judicial corruption. He was really before his time. He was a criminologist. He went out and argued that poverty causes crime, that the death penalty should be abolished except for treason and murder. And he had a particular argument that probably the blight on English justice until it took Dickens to remove it was imprisonment for debt, and he wanted to abolish that. So he was a really extremely radical figure, entrusted with the prosecution of the king because no one else would take it. There was the lawyers fled when the instructions came from Parliament to prosecute the king. He was one of the very few lawyers who was prepared to pick up this poison chalice.
And to some degree, they're treating him like a war criminal. And I was really stunned when I read in your book about the dramatic opening of the trial, because it just sounded so much like the opening of Saddam Hussein's trial centuries later.
It was Cook's problem was that the king was believed by many people to be divinely appointed. He had sovereign immunity because he was the sovereign. His own lawyers, he had the best lawyers in the country, who said, "Look, you can't, Magna Carta promises trial by peers, so you can't be tried because you've got no peer." And John Cook had to solve this paradox, and he did so by creating the crime of tyranny. He charged the king with tyranny and with war crimes, with torturing, ordering the torture of prisoners of war, which was a war crime even then, and plundering innocent civilians in the course of making war on his own people, with mass murdering his own people. And it was an extraordinary moment, I think probably one of the greatest moments in our shared history, England and America, when the king was finally brought in before 70 judges who were the most respectable men in the country. And John Cook, standing beside him, opened the case, and the king struck him with a cane and said, "Hold!" He had a cane with a beautiful pure silver tip. And Cook went on, and then he hit him a little harder and said, "Hold!" And Cook still continued addressing the judge. And then he gave him a real whack, and the silver tip dislodged and clattered down between the two men. And this was in Westminster Hall, and 10,000 people observed when the king motioned to Cook to get down and pick it up. And Cook refused. He continued. And the king had to bend down and scrabble around at the barrister's feet to find the tip. And for the first time, this symbolized the first time in English history when the autocratic, absolutist ruler, the monarch, had to bend, as it were, before the law.
However, it was the first time in European history as well, yeah. Because no ruler had ever been held accountable. Did he receive a fair trial even without a jury of his peers?
Well, it was interesting. This is where the parallels with Saddam Hussein and Milosevic come in. The king refused to plead, and he said consistently, "By what power do you try me?" Which is what Saddam Hussein said, what Milosevic said. The answer, I guess, is by the power that supplanted yours. But that wasn't made at the time, and they had arguments for 4 days. And this was pretty amazing. And at a time when no one's trial took longer than a day, and when people who didn't plead in the ordinary courts had great stones put on their chests until they either pleaded or were crushed to death. So by the barbaric standards of the time, this was an incredibly fair trial. But the king maintained his position. And this is why I think, in a way, the king was a better tactician than Milosevic, who entered into the fray.
And we will return to that after we take a little break. My guest is Jeffrey Robertson, whose latest book is called The Tyrannicide Brief, The Story of the Man Who Sent Charles I to the Scaffold. It is published by Pantheon. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
And we're back with Jeffrey Robertson, a leading human rights lawyer and a UN war crimes judge who has won landmark rulings in civil liberties from the highest courts in Britain, Europe, and the British Commonwealth. He was involved in the cases against General Pinochet and Hastings Banda and in training judges for the trial of Saddam Hussein. His latest book is called The Tyrannicide Brief, and it is published by Pantheon. The decision was made ultimately to behead the king. That had to have been an even more incredible step than putting him on trial.
I guess the two factors influenced it. I don't think they started the trial with the belief that the king would be sentenced to death at the end of it. The king made the mistake that many prisoners make of talking to his guards and boasting about the fact that he never lost a moment's sleep about all the dead in the Civil War. And given the carnage that the Civil War had cost, the judges came to think, when that was reported back to them, that he was entirely without remorse, and he would go on with for a third, fourth civil war until he won. There was also the difficulty of replacing him. I mean, he had a younger son at 8 who could have been put on the throne, but he would be put in exile, and no matter how far away you put him, he'd still be back at the head of an attacking army. So I think that contributed to the decision to execute him, which in turn, of course, made him a martyr, as execution does, and enabled his son Charles II to have sufficient support 11 years later to come back and for a restored monarchy.
Although in France later they killed everybody, and in Russia they killed everybody to prevent that sort of thing.
Yeah.
What was the reaction to the trial and execution of the king? Was opinion divided in England? I'd assume that people, that upper-class people, people who had some royal connections, would have been horrified, whereas the poor people might very well have seen this as something quite good.
I think, it was a bit like 9/11. It was astounding, particularly in Europe, where Machiavelli's princes and kings were in control. It was, I mean, the Treaty of Westphalia that had ended the Civil War had promised rulers immunity, and suddenly here was England, that was not part of the treaty, putting its king to death for tyranny and for war crimes, and that was astonishing. I think, obviously, one mistake you could say that the Cromwell and the Republicans made is that they didn't mop up. They didn't, as in France, kill not just the king but everyone else who might have supported him. There were a few trials conducted later of the king's war criminals, but most of them were spared. Only two went to the scaffold. And so you could say that the Republic, in a way, sealed its own fate by not rounding up and by forgiving to a large extent those who'd fought for the king, who remained royalists at heart and came back with a vengeance, and vengeance with a capital
well,
V.
Well, Cook was tried and executed under Charles II.
Yeah, that was very interesting because Cook was one of a number of regicides, as they were then called, because they established a republic and they abolished the House of Lords. But when the Restoration came, Charles II personally watched as they were disemboweled. Cook was hung without and cut down before he lost consciousness. His genitals were sliced off and thrown to the dogs, and then he was his bowels were ripped out and burnt in front of his goggling eyes. So he died, in a sense, in his own stench, the worst torturous death that could be devised. And Hugh Peters, his great close friend, whom he looked after in prison, the founder of Harvard College, was the next on the scaffold. But 10 of them were treated like this, and they were so brave that the crowd started to turn against the king, and it was impossible to put the rest to death. So you had all these Republicans in prison, dangerous Republicans, and the king didn't know, because habeas corpus operated, they couldn't be brought to trial. What could he do with them? And he had a very smart legal advisor who said, I know what we'll do. We'll put them on offshore islands where habeas corpus doesn't run. And this was the precedent for Guantanamo Bay. And it was regarded as devious even then.
It sounds like nothing has changed since the 17th century. In fact, law, you suggest, hasn't changed much.
Torture
since
is still
Cook.
On the agenda. We've got trials of tyrants. We've got, and in fact, in 1679, Parliament passed the Habeas Corpus Act, which applied habeas corpus to offshore islands, because all these Republicans had been stuffed on Jersey, which was the Guantanamo Bay that Charles II devised. And when a case came in the Supreme Court a couple of years ago, Rosalind Bush, Justice Stevens pointed out that the Bush administration had overlooked the fact that the 1679 Habeas Corpus Act, which applied due process to offshore islands, was actually still applied to America, which was part of Britain at the time.
Do you think that if Cromwell hadn't become the dictator and England had remained a republic, that everything would have been different, or would the Restoration have occurred anyway?
I think the great mistake, and I mean, we had a republic for 4 years, and then Cromwell abolished Parliament, and he was set up as a Lord Protector, and at first...
And then eventually even had his son in
line. Well, that was the tragedy. I mean, he was offered the crown. Cook was with him, and I think persuaded him not to take it because, you know, the Puritans believed that if you acted properly, you might be elected as a saint, and no saint would accept a crown. And Cromwell didn't, but he accepted the next best thing, which was, in effect, a king in all but name, and he got the right to nominate his successor. And that was a tragedy because he nominated his eldest son, Richard Tumbledown Dick, who was completely incapable. And, of course, there were men around, John Lambert in particular, who could have saved the Republic. But, of course, tragically, he didn't. And so I think that if Cromwell had appointed Lambert, things might well have turned out differently. But it was the fate, the ironic fate, that the Republic came a cropper because he acted like a king.
Well, I can understand why British history has been taught the way it has. But still, Charles I was quite an awful man. Are British schoolboys, school children, totally unaware?
Yeah. The Church of England used to say special prayers for him every January the 30th, the date of his execution. And the English tend to white out of history the Republic, because it seems to me that in this period is the time when the Western values that we now assert against the terrorists, the sovereignty of Parliament, independence of judges, end of torture, comparative religious tolerance. I mean, Cromwell, let's face it, brought back the Jews to England in 1653. The freedom to preach were all established at this period, that the sinews, if you like, of democracy, the end of torture.
On the other hand, and Cromwell did bring them back in hopes of converting them.
But I think there was a mixture. He brought them back partly because of the wealth that they brought with them or would create, and partly because of a biblical prophecy. So he had mixed motives, but it was nonetheless the Puritans were prepared to tolerate all religions except, of course, the Catholic. They looked on the Pope with some good reason, rather as if he was bin Laden.
You say that Churchill was haunted by Charles I's martyrdom at Nuremberg.
The received wisdom was that the trial of Charles I was a bit of a disaster for Cromwell because it turned the king into a martyr. And it made his why Churchill opposed Truman and Jackson, who wanted to set up a trial for the Nazi leaders, was that he didn't want to give Hitler a soapbox. And you know, you can see this in a sense reflected with Milosevic in his trial. But he didn't, and so he opposed tooth and nail Nuremberg. He wanted to have the top 75 Nazis shot 6 hours after arrest, and so it was a deadlock. And ironically, we only got Nuremberg because the casting vote went to Joe Stalin, who loved show trials as long as everyone got shot in the end.
Right. He's lucky that he didn't face his own trial.
Well, exactly.
Before the Iraq invasion, you wrote in The Guardian that George W. Bush should use law, not war, to handle Saddam Hussein. Would there have been any possible legal justification for U.S. forces to depose Saddam? I mean, how would they have gone after them?
What should have happened, obviously, if we had followed international law, was that he should have been dealt with in 1988-89 when he was running the Anfal campaign that was gassing the Kurds. That was genocide. We had a genocide convention that required the nations of the world to act. It was much easier back then. We didn't act. We didn't act on the genocide convention in Rwanda, and we're still worried about how to act in Darfur. So I think there are parallels, quite striking parallels, certainly in the death penalty. I've been one of the British lawyers arguing with American lawyers about whether Saddam should have faced an international court, and the American said, well, no, because international courts can't execute him. And what they wanted is what they'll get, is Saddam taken out into some dusty square and strung up from a lamppost with shouts of joy from the Shias. And
the kind of Mussolini end.
Yeah, and that will be the Charles. He will then become, no doubt, a martyr. The Civil War will be revved up. And, you know, the White House lawyers said, well, okay, what's your alternative? We can't can't leave him in Iraq. If he's convicted, obviously you couldn't. So I advised the government that we should start to make St. Helena available, which had been used for Napoleon. Well, the problem with that was that the people of St. Helena wanted to turn it into a tourist island and didn't want Saddam there. So I suggested the Falkland Islands. It seems to me that...
Nobody seems to want that except Margaret Thatcher.
Well, exactly. And if you don't want the death penalty, then you have to come up with an alternative. And I think having the likes of... Saddam Hussein and the late Slobodan Milosevic communing with the penguins in the Falklands would be, and never heard of again, would be an appropriate penalty for tyrants.
You've hosted a television program called Hypotheticals, and Lawrence Wright today had an op-ed piece in the New York Times in which he suggested what we might do with bin Laden if he were ever caught. He said we should turn him over to Kenya and Tanzania for trial and hope that he's sent to Saudi Arabia.
and he wanted and him they, taken they, out to Chop Chop Square, didn't he?
Yes.
But the problem, of course, with his scenario, right, the penny didn't fully drop because he wanted him ending in Chop Chop Square with the sacred sword coming down on the Wahhabi. But he didn't realize that under Saudi law, his victims could, in fact, do a deal in which they received large sums of money in return for his life. So given the fortunes of the bin Ladens, I would suspect that the sad thing is that the victims would be bought off, as Gaddafi's victims of the Pan Am crash were bought off. You'd take their millions and forget your grief. And so bin Laden might well, this idea of punishing him under Saudi law, he may well walk out a free man.
Well, we're faced with a few possible trials. Well, Pinochet is being prosecuted.
Yes, indeed.
In Chile. There's Charles Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
The Saddam Hussein trial has not yet been resolved. Do you see a change now? Are we?
Yeah, I think we are more prepared to... I think Pinochet was perhaps the modern turning point. I acted for Human Rights Watch in that very dramatic case where we won 3-2 in the House of Lords to begin with, and then they discovered that one of the judges had a wife who worked for Amnesty International. So they then had to sit again. They had to find 7 judges who had no connection at all with any human rights organization. So they got these 7 guys who had been commercial lawyers and wouldn't know a human right if they fell over it. And the delightful thing was that these guys were contract lawyers, Pinochet's final panel of judges, and they weren't international lawyers. And they opened the torture convention, which Pinochet had signed like everyone else, not dreaming that it would ever be enforced. And they said, they read it like a commercial contract. They said, this must mean when it says everyone who tortures has to be either tried or extradited to a country that will try. And so that's how I think law was and perceptions were changed by the Pinochet being the first dictator to lose sovereign immunity since Charles I. And that was the beginning. And then Jean Kambanda, who was the Prime Minister of Rwanda and others. And so now political and military leaders are liable to international criminal law.
Jeffrey Robertson's book, The Tyrannicide Brief, the story of the man who sent Charles I to the scaffold, is published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Leonard.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.